Hey, True Crime Mamas. This is your co-host, Christina, and today I'm here with Lindsay. Hey, Lindsay.
Hello.
So, Lindsay and I share a special bond because we both are special needs mamas, and Lindsay just had a really big change happen in her house in the past couple of weeks. Do you want to tell everyone?
So, my 3.5-year-old has a very rare chromosome deletion, and we just got her in our local EC pre-K program. And it was really exciting. I mean, we've been waiting, like COVID, God forbid COVID, pushed it really far behind. So she had a couple of extra months home with me. And, you know, we started her out gradually, a couple of days, 4 hours, 5 hours a day. And we just recently boosted up to a full day, which is from about 8:30 to about 2:30. And I was really nervous about how she was going to do because they do naps.
Oh, wow.
And Chantry hasn't been napping for a while. And surprisingly, the first day I picked her up, they were like, she didn't really nap per se, but she did lay down and she didn't move and she didn't make a peep. She just got really upset because she could see me pull up when I pulled up to pick her up. And bless her heart, she gets so emotional when I pick her up. It's like she sees the car. She knows our car. And her teacher opens the door, and she's just got, like, these crocodile tears.
Aww.
And she's like, Mommy! And every time she does it, I just want to cry. Like, it's the sweetest thing, but it also reminds me, like, my kids are growing up. And I only have one kid at home with me now while the other three are in school. And so it's been really emotional, but it's been really, really good for her because she's needed that socialization and it's just going to help her flourish. So we're excited and it's gone great so far.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, it's always tough to let our special ones out of the nest. And
it's very tough. When I dropped her off the first day, I was like, hysterically crying, and my husband was with me, and he was like, babe, it's okay, she's only there for a couple of hours. I was like, I know, but you know, as moms, first days are really hard, and then add, you know, our special needs baby on top of it, and who we've never really left anywhere, and it makes it even harder. So
well, congratulations, mama, for making it through a couple of weeks of school so far.
Yeah, it's been fun. And I'm getting a lot more done around the house. I hate to say that, but I mean, it makes it a lot easier with when my 1-year-old lays down, I can finally like do stuff and be productive versus following both of them around the house and making sure like her biggest thing was getting into the fish tank.
Oh boy.
When I was trying to do stuff. So I don't have to worry about that anymore.
Well, there are some blessings in this.
That is true.
Well, today we're going to be talking about a case that Lindsay and I have been deeply involved in since we started working on it, and honestly have developed quite a passion for the case as well as the victim's mom. And we're going to dig in just a few minutes, so please stay tuned. On Thursday, September 12, 2019, officers responded to 711 South Church Street, Apartment A, in reference to a welfare check. Sergeant Ruth and Officer Henderson arrived on scene and met with Brandon's mom, Sarah Lee, and his sister, Rachel. Sarah had contacted Ashboro Police because she was unable to make contact with Brandon. The last time she heard from Brandon was on Tuesday, September 10th. Although she had tried to call Brandon, he wasn't answering his phone. When Sarah and Rachel got to Brandon's apartment, they found that his truck was parked right in front of his apartment. After knocking on the doors and windows and getting no response, Sarah contacted police.
When police arrived, they attempted to make contact with Brandon. After being unable to make contact, the police contacted the property manager to unlock the door. Once the property manager unlocked the door, both Officer Henderson and Officer Kivett, who had both recently arrived on scene, entered Brandon's apartment. According to the incident report, quote, officers observed that the apartment was very cluttered and disorganized. Officers heard the sound of running water coming from the back bedroom. Officers approached the back bedroom and observed Mr. Embry lying on the floor near the bedroom door, end quote. Brandon was found gasping for air, unconscious, beaten, nude on the floor in his bedroom.
EMS and fire arrived on scene and began providing care. EMTs administered Narcan, but there was no effect.
Brandon was transported to Randolph Health for further medical attention. Officers secured the scene and began their investigation. And less than 6 months later, Sarah was asked to attend a meeting at the Asheboro Police Department. She was informed that there was not enough there to investigate Brandon's case as a homicide, and the case was closed.
Brandon Wesley Embry was born on September 7, 1986 in Lexington, Kentucky. He was raised in a military family and had the opportunity to live in various states as well as overseas in Italy. After graduating from high school, he enlisted into the United States Navy as a nuclear machinist mate, petty officer, second class. When he was honorably discharged from the Navy, he received several degrees, his final being an associate's degree in bioengineering and chemical pre-engineering with high honors at Green River College in Auburn, Washington. I mean, goodness.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. Smart guy.
And that's a really cool degree to have, too. Like, I always think of bioengineers as, like, extremely intelligent people.
I do, too.
So, after experiencing a difficult breakup, Brandon's mother, Sarah, convinced him to relocate close to his family in North Carolina. He ended up finding a place to live in Asheboro, North Carolina, close to his family, who lives in a small community of Ramseur, North Carolina. During his year in North Carolina, he found employment as a welder. For a short time, he worked for local welding companies and eventually found a better paying job in which he commuted to Texas 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. He then found a better opportunity with a role in Charlotte repairing robotics.
Brandon is described as an introverted but a gentle soul. His ex-girlfriend Jessica said he was a kind-hearted person. He wanted to build a future for himself and the people he loved. She also mentioned he was passionate about working on his car, which was an older Camaro. Sarah, Brandon's mom, describes him best.
Yeah, that's, you know, just his nature. He was just a really peaceful person. He had more of a serious demeanor, but when he said something funny, it was that, like, you know, that really humorous thing because it would be like so much truth to it. He wasn't a silly person at all, just very serious, but he had a good sense of humor as well. And he would go to great lengths to help people. And a lot of his friends that have reached out to me, one of the things that I hear all of them say is Brandon helped me so much with. And that is, you know, something that just so many people have in common. He wanted to kind of be that knight in shining armor for people. He was there for people. He was very intelligent. He kind of sometimes maybe had that ivory tower personality. But if you ever talked to him about any subject, if you could really get him engaged, because he was a bit of an introvert, he would be well-versed on almost anything and have something intelligent and valuable to contribute to the conversation. He was a great conversationalist, and that's something that I really miss, is just to be able to call him up and have a conversation with him.
Like many of the true crime mamas, Brandon had tattoos which were meaningful to him.
What was the Viking tattoo about? Was he into Vikings, or was it because of being in the Navy?
He loved the Viking culture. He learned to make homemade mead that he would bottle and make. He had different flavors, and I saw there was like a honeysuckle flavor, and I believe there was like one with flowers, like a hibiscus flavor. And I mean, I was like, wow, you know, maybe that's something that I could have done with him later on, because I can't imagine where you would even start to do something like that. And he made his own. And he just loved the whole like Viking culture. And then he had moved to North Carolina from Seattle. And actually there is a city or a town in the Seattle like area. I think it's called Paulsbo. And it is all Viking culture in that town. So he really like fit in there with that. And at one time he had this like beard that was all the way down to his waist. I mean, just the full Viking experience with him. But he did have a lot of tattoos. He liked the ink. One of my favorite tattoos that he had was a large koi fish that the koi fish came over his shoulder. So it started on the back of his shoulder and it came over to the front. So the mouth of the koi fish was like on the front of his chest.
So Brandon sounds like somebody who probably would have been in our friend group.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah,
pretty cool guy. I love the fact that he made meat. I mean,
That is like the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, it really is. And the whole Viking thing, I think about all the different shows that have been on TV. I'm like, wow.
I know. That's like what and then I love how she said that he had a beard at one point that was down to his waist. Like, I would have liked to have seen that. I know one person who has a really long beard like that, and I think that it's just so badass.
I think it is, too. Kind of like ZZ Top, which, yes. I mean, even though they're so much older than us, they're so badass and so cool. So one night I was scrolling through Facebook, and you know that part on Facebook where it always says pages you might like or may like?
Suggested
pages. Yeah, suggested pages. Yeah. And so there is this picture of a guy who was in a Navy outfit, or uniform is probably the more proper term, and it was called Brandon's Voice. And I thought, well, it's probably not North Carolina, but the picture had me hooked because I'm a former military brat. Yep. So got to see what this is about. And I feel like that between the two of us, we're connoisseurs of all things crime in North Carolina.
Yeah,
I'd
say so.
So I figured, you know, obviously this is in another state. I have no idea what this is about, but it's not something that happened here.
Yeah.
Well, lo and behold, it was something that had happened here. Never heard of the case before. So I liked it, started just digging in, ended up spending a couple hours reading through some of the posts. There's quite a few.
Oh, yeah.
And then I mentioned the case to you, and you liked the
case.
Then
I got hooked on the case.
Yeah, and I think that the reason that we wanted to cover this case is because there's not a lot of information out there on Brandon.
Nope. I mean, I've brought this case up to a couple of other friends that I know are, you know, they follow quite a few crime. They're big into crimes and stuff like that. And they had never heard of the case. And I was just like, this is a big case. Why is there not more coverage on this case? This is crazy. So
yeah, I mean, you can go and search Brandon Embry on Google, and there is just very limited coverage about his death, which, I mean, it was a pretty violent death, and you would think there would be a lot more information. So we were surprised, and of course, challenge accepted. We decided to dig in and see what we could find out.
Exactly. So before we get much further, let's go back to February of 2019. Brandon mentioned to his sister, Rachel, that he was seeing a girl, but he didn't think it was going to go anywhere because she was returning to Russia.
That's not very common to have a girl in the Ashburn area who's from Russia.
So for this female, we're going to call her Female One. So around this same time, from February 18th through February 22nd, Brandon was actually hospitalized for a week.
We're going to take you to an excerpt from the interview with Brandon's mom, Sarah, so she can describe what happened.
Here it has been 2 years later, but that first time that Brandon went into the hospital, and it was so mysterious and nobody understood why, but that was his medical record, and not until, you know, just now, because I just stay so busy with everything, but I finally sat down. There was 539 pages, and I sat there for 2 days, and I went through every single page to make notes, to go for everything. And that's when I realized that there was poisoning.
According to the CDC, ethylene glycol is an industrial compound found in items such as automotive antifreeze, hydraulic brake fluids, solvents, paints, and plastics. It has a sweet taste and is often accidentally or intentionally ingested. It's chemically broken down in the body into toxic compounds. It and its toxic byproducts first affect the central nervous system, then the heart, and finally the kidneys. Ingestion of sufficient amounts can be fatal. Ethylene glycol is odorless. Odor does not provide any warning of inhalation exposure to hazardous concentration.
So after ingestion, ethylene glycol is rapidly absorbed within 1 to 4 hours through the stomach. Following the absorption, 80% or more of the ethylene glycol is chemically converted by the body into toxic compounds. The course of the ethylene glycol toxicity is classically divided into three broad overlapping categories of adverse health effects. So stage one is the neurological stage, and it lasts from 30 minutes to 12 hours after the ingestion. Stage two is the cardiopulmonary stage, and it occurs between 12 and 24 hours after ingestion. And stage three is the renal stage, which occurs between 24 and 72 hours after ingestion. Adverse health effects can be delayed significantly by the co-ingestion of alcohol.
So let's listen to Sarah tell us what happened to Brandon in her own words.
Brandon was really confused when he woke up. February of 2019, 7 months before my son was murdered, he had been admitted to the hospital in High Point, North Carolina. It was a Monday morning. Brandon had arrived to work, and his supervisor observed that he seemed to be in an altered state. So the supervisor sent Brandon off-site to do a urinalysis. He stopped at a McDonald's to get food, where someone at the McDonald's also noticed that he seemed to be in this altered state, so they called the police. Someone saw him throwing up, so the EMTs took him from the McDonald's to the hospital in High Point. His symptoms were severe, so they admitted him to the intensive care unit. They never made a diagnosis of actually what was wrong with him, and they did not tell me how severe his symptoms actually were. Brandon had been on life support in the ICU for a couple of days before they got in touch with me. I didn't know that he had been on dialysis. I did know that they intubated him. The dialysis is probably what saved his life the first time. When they finally brought him out of the induced coma, he was very confused. He really didn't understand the whole situation. To him, he had went to McDonald's. He really wasn't feeling that well, and he felt like he had been profiled or targeted as a drug addict, and they made him go to the hospital. All of the drug tests come back clear. Brandon is brought out of the coma and he wakes up. He's lost a week of his life and he doesn't understand why. 10 days before Brandon had went in the hospital, he was talking to his sister and he told her that he was dating a girl from Russia.
After Brandon's death, Female One began communication with Brandon's mom, Sarah. She shared that Brandon told her in February that he felt he was going to die soon. She said they were together for Valentine's Day. I recall the first time he told me this, I'm going to die. I'm not going to be here long.
So was Brandon poisoned by antifreeze in February?
I don't know. I mean, listening to her and then just understanding the effects, I think it's a strong possibility.
Did she say, I know she went back just recently and read through everything relating back to when he was first hospitalized his first time. Did she say that they did find traces of the antifreeze then?
She didn't actually say that, and that's something that she has a pretty extensive to-do list.
Yeah.
So what she wants to do is take the medical records back to the hospital and see if they can examine them and look at it from that lens and say, okay, was this maybe the antifreeze or was it something completely separate? Because we'll find out in a few minutes what they thought it was. It definitely wasn't based on hospital reports.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it seems that the shoe fits for poisoning.
100%. Oh, absolutely.
So at the time of his death, Brandon was talking to another woman who we're going to call Female 2. And according to Female 2, she only knew Brandon for a short time, and she met him in person just once. She said he was a very nice guy, and they talked frequently on the phone. And she wanted to make it clear that she didn't know him to the extent that others did. She said, "We weren't that close. Up until recently, I did not know he was still involved with his ex." Well, I guess it wouldn't be his ex, girlfriend. "And while he and I were getting to know each other, flirting, etc."
She said that she and Brandon had met on a dating app. On August 11th, she met him for the only time in Asheboro at his home. She said in hindsight, it was dangerous, and she was fortunate he was a nice guy. She said he was super funny, a sweet guy, and even though he had a super intimidating appearance, he was very soft and caring. She also said that he had a nice sense of humor, and they laughed a lot. She then stated, "At the time, I'd like to think he was honest, but I'm not sure now. I hope that doesn't sound ugly."
As the conversation progressed, she said that she had talked to him briefly on the phone a couple days before he died. And she found out about his passing from an Asheboro detective who actually informed her.
So when I asked what she thought happened to Brandon, she said the following. "I know the police say that he went into a psychosis and did all the damage himself, that he died of pneumonia. I'm not sure, though. It really, really seems like someone broke into his home and brutally did this to him. I'm in no way a doctor or have the educational background to make the call. But the whole situation of his death seems very odd."
When asked if Brandon ever mentioned having any enemies or problems with anyone, she said, "The only thing he ever said was that he had a crazy ex. I never thought anything of it because if you ask me about my ex, well, I mean, I'd probably say he's crazy. But never did any mortal enemies or that he had animosity with anyone."
I did ask her if she ever met Female One, and she said, "Nope, I never met her or have said a word to her. Sarah always made it sound like she was suspect number one in his death. So I never opened that can of worms." And then there was an emoji with big eyes. "Like I said, we didn't really talk that long or were a thing. Just getting to know each other, talking and such."
So let's jump back to Female One. I had a phone number for her and attempted to make contact several times with no response. Eventually, I went on her mostly locked down Facebook page and attempted contact with 21 people who liked or loved her pictures. "Hello, friend. I am writing in hopes you can help me. I'm trying to get in touch with Female One. I am a co-host on a podcast and I am covering a case on a man by the name of Brandon Embry. From what I have researched, I understand that Female One and Brandon were romantically involved close to the time of his death. I would like to talk with her and understand her perspective on the case. Would you mind reaching out to her and giving her my phone number? She is welcome to call or text me."
So within an hour, I heard back from a male friend, and we'll just call him S for these purposes. And he said initially, "I don't see your name in those articles, and I don't even think she lives in North Carolina. I think you have the wrong person." I explained to him that she never lived in North Carolina, but had lived in South Carolina at the time that she met Brandon. He then stated, "Oh, I thought she'd been in Colorado for the last 5 years." And Lindsay, what's really interesting is even some of her family members thought she'd been in Colorado for the past 5 to 6 years.
I can't imagine, like, hiding my whereabouts from my family or even lying to them about my whereabouts.
It seems kind of sketchy, but I mean, maybe she has her reasons. We don't know. So I did acknowledge that her phone number was the Colorado area code, but I believe she was using an internet phone. I reassured him I only wanted to understand her version of what happened to ensure she was accurately represented in the episode. He agreed to reach out to her, and this was his final response. "I'm sorry. She said she does not want to contact you in regards to this."
Wow.
Yeah. And then shortly after, he blocked me from communicating with him again. And then Female One blocked me as well.
That's not fishy.
No, not at all. And eventually, in other conversations, I was able to discover that female one appeared to have deleted her entire Facebook profile.
Yeah, I noticed that because I originally was able to find her too. And then after we had this conversation and you told me you had reached out to her, you were like, I'm pretty sure she deleted her whole entire Facebook. And so I went, this sounds crazy. So I have two different Facebooks because I get put in Facebook jail a lot. So I need a backup account. And, you know, I'm not blocked from a lot of people on that second account. Nobody really knows it exists. So I couldn't find her on my regular Facebook. So then I went to the other Facebook and tried to find her, and I couldn't find her there either. So she had literally, like you said, completely locked down, deleted, poof, be gone, this Facebook.
As we like to say in the South, she gone.
She gone.
She gone. So, I did receive a message from another friend who we're going to call T, and they had been in communication, him and female one, from April 3rd, 2020 to December 23rd, 2020, but they never met in person. They made plenty of arrangements to meet up for dinner several times, but for one reason or another, it always fell through. And when he asked female one how they met, she claimed to have met him in prison where he served 3 months in 2017. During the conversation, she claimed to work in booking and receiving in the jail. And then in April 2020, while on her way to purchase illicit substances for T's friend, she had a rollover car accident where she claimed she had to get 45 stitches. T said that she always unnerved him and that she was the sketchiest person he had ever met.
That is just, I don't know. I guess it's because, like, I've never tried to do, like, the dating scene online. I've been with my husband for 12 years now. But if somebody is constantly making up excuses to say, oh, I can't meet you, and you've literally never met this person, at this point, I would be like, this person is psycho.
Yeah.
Like,
I met my husband online back when it was not okay to meet people online. And we didn't tell anyone because it was so taboo.
Yeah.
But our relationship gradually progressed. So from messages to phone calls, and then a few months later, an in-person date.
Yeah.
But there was a progression. And it's interesting that he kept talking to her for all this time, and there was no progression whatsoever. No. It was more start and stop.
Yeah. And a lot of times he would ask her a question, and then she would just ignore it. And then a couple of days later,
Or weeks,
she would come back with, like, a completely different topic and just completely disregarded the question that he had previously asked her. So I just find that really weird.
Yeah.
Like, really weird.
Agreed.
So 5 days after Brandon's death, on September 18th, female one contacted Brandon's sister-in-law through Facebook. And she claimed she was a girlfriend of Brandon's and stated that she knew a lot of information about him. So we'll discuss this a little later on.
Hey, y'all. If you're looking to do some renovation and want to support a local small business, check out Sensible Spaces. They're owned and operated by one of our own True Crime Mamas, Heidi, and her husband, Kyle. They recently remodeled my master bathroom. It was a 1990s bathroom that needed a serious facelift. They transformed it into a classic, timeless look that you can check out on their Instagram, at Sensible Spaces. Sensible Spaces is local and services the Triad. If you need any renovation work done in your home, check them out on Instagram or on their website, sensible-spaces.com. I know you will love their work. I sure did.
So we're now going to go back to a few days before Brandon's death. On Friday afternoon, September 6, 2019, Brandon went to his mom Sarah's house to dog sit. Sarah has 5 dogs and they're big dogs.
Yeah.
She has 4 that are German Shepherd Malinois mixes and 1 that's a full-blooded Malinois.
And those are ginormous dogs.
Ginormous. But she seems to manage them really well. When we were talking with her on the phone, if they got a little rowdy, she would say, hold on for a second. And then she would come right back and it was quiet.
Yeah.
I wish that she would come over and train Jack Bauer. But I don't know if he's trainable. So, according to Sarah, Brandon walked in and just melted into the floor to play with the dogs. He was smiling and laughing. And then the next day on her way back home, she was coming from Kentucky. She called him to tell him happy birthday. He seemed anxious for a return, but Sarah just said, okay, well, it's probably because he has plans to go out and celebrate. And before she made it home, Brandon had left.
So Brandon had actually texted his stepdad at 7:36 p.m. that evening and said he had plans to meet this girl, but she had canceled on him. On Monday, September 9th at 4:21 p.m., Brandon texted his mom, Sarah, to tell her that he had a bad headache. He had complained that it was terrible timing because he had all these things that he needed to take care of.
Then on Tuesday, September 10th, Brandon texted Sarah at 6:30 that morning. She returned his call later in the day, but he didn't answer. Later that morning at 11:27 a.m., there's a receipt for $20.28 from Adam and Eve, which is a local adult store. Although the item purchased is not disclosed, we did find out it was an item for a female and probably something Brandon wouldn't purchase if he wasn't shopping alone. The detective on his case confirmed that Brandon's phone pinged in the same area that day. Additionally, bank statements show that Brandon had made a purchase at Jade Express in Randolph Mall for $17.28.
That same evening, he also had talked to female 2 around 9:30 p.m. It was a 13-minute phone call. On Wednesday, September 11th, female 2 said that she called Brandon around 1:30 p.m., but he didn't answer. And additionally, a neighbor reported that a FedEx truck actually tried to make a delivery, but there was no answer at Brandon's apartment door.
Later that night, Sarah tried calling Brandon, but there was no answer. And then she did something I think it was really smart. She went on her cell phone and tried to ping his location. Yeah. But she said that when she did do that, that his location just spun around and she couldn't locate him. So at this point, she's pretty worried and decides that she's going to go to his apartment to check on him the next morning.
So on Thursday, September 12th, Rachel, Brandon's sister, convinced their mom, Sarah, to wait to go over to Brandon's apartment. And so they didn't arrive until about 2:45 p.m. that afternoon. So they knocked on Brandon's door, but they didn't get any answer, and the door was locked. So they went around to Brandon's back door, and that door was also locked. However, the window to his back bedroom was broken.
Sarah called 911 at 3 p.m.
September 12th, 2019, 15 hours, 15 minutes, 21 seconds.
Randolph County 911, where's your emergency?
My son, he's at 711 Church Street apartment, and I have been trying to get a hold of him for 2 days, and also my daughter, the neighbors have been knocking, his truck's here. And he just nobody is answering, so it's just really not, it just seems like something's not right.
I think you said it was 711 South Church Street?
711 Church Street, right? Yeah, 711 Church Street apartment.
Okay, and you're there now?
Yeah, and I'm my daughter's pounding on the door. We went to every single window, and the back window is broke. The neighbor pounded yesterday, they tried to FedEx came to deliver, he's not answering.
What's your name, ma'am? What's your son's name? Okay. And what's the telephone number you're calling from?
My cell phone is area code 9.
And are you going to be on foot or in a vehicle?
Pardon?
Are you going to be standing by on foot or in a vehicle?
Yeah, I'm going to keep knocking on the doors.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm waiting. So
he said his vehicle is there as well?
Yeah, his truck is here.
When was the last time you spoke to him?
Like 3 nights ago. And he kind of wasn't doing too good, emotionally. So that also has me concerned. He just, lost his job and stuff. So.
All right. And just confirming it's 711 South Church Street apartment.
Yes.
Okay. All right. We'll get an officer out there as soon as possible.
Yeah. Please hurry. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. They'll be there as soon as possible.
Okay.
When first responders arrive, Brandon is found on his bedroom floor. According to the search warrant, Detective Macon describes how he found Brandon. He located Mr. Embry naked on the bedroom floor. Mr. Embry had numerous wounds to include face and head wounds. There were bloodstains in the apartment in several areas and also overturned furniture. Mr. Embry also had wounds around both wrists and appeared to be consistent with marks from handcuffs, of which a pair were found in the apartment on a small stand. Mr. Embry was rushed to Randolph Health and was unresponsive.
In the ER waiting area, detectives questioned Brandon's mom, Sarah, about Brandon. Information is relayed between the detectives and the doctor, and eventually the ER doctor told Sarah and family that Brandon's prognosis was not good and that he was in need of a higher level of care. He was then transferred to Moses Cone Hospital in Greensboro.
So on Friday, September 13th, Sarah made contact with a family member, and she was an experienced ICU nurse. And this person was actually en route to Brandon, but had a lot of questions. And Sarah was initially acting as a go-between, mm-hmm. but she was struggling with understanding some of the technical things. And I totally get that. My mom is a retired nurse, and if I have medical questions, she's who I go to first. So when the nurse was actually talking to this family member, Sarah watched the nurse pull up a screen, and on the screen, she saw a 3D graft image of a head, and there was a large portion grafted in red on the right side of the head.
So Brandon had bruising around his eyes, and a friend of Sarah's told her that this was what they called raccoon eyes. And medical professionals assume when this is pregnant that there's been a skull fracture. So it made sense to Sarah. In addition to the eyes, there was a thick globular blood from his nose, and the entire right side of his head was super swollen.
And later, when reviewing Brandon's medical notes from Randolph Health, Sarah read, and I'm going to put in quotes, "and fluid within the right maxillary sinus and sphenoid. Small amount of fluid within the right mastoid air cells." This is actually the same area that Sarah saw that was red on the 3D scan. And she also found out that fluid isn't supposed to be there. So, like I said before, I don't know a lot about medical things, but one thing that Sarah talked about was the battle wound. And that was something where someone has a skull fracture, there is a wound on the side of the head. And she wasn't able to see that because Brandon was in a C-collar, but feels very strongly that there was a head fracture, especially based on the information.
Yeah.
So we're just going to listen to a couple segments of what Sarah experienced with Brandon in the hospital.
So the one thing that was abnormal was his neck. And the head scan is not very clear at all, but if you look very closely, the bones are not, you know, they call it a spinal column because the bones are in a column. Mm-hmm. The bones don't move around, and you can see in the column or in the photo that the bones are like off, like one is over to the side, and it looks like his neck was, you know, the spinal column's displaced, and that would paralyze him for sure. And that's why I think he was moved, because I'm just thinking that I don't think he could move on his own. But in the medical note, they said possibly he has scoliosis. And I know he didn't have scoliosis, and they wouldn't have let him in the military.
Exactly. He would have been 4F'd. Like yeah.
Yes. And, you know, it's just, there was just a lot of mistakes, but it's also understandable because he was in such critical care that there wasn't a lot that they could do as far as like trying to probably get a better scan, because they wanted to do things in the second hospital that they couldn't, because they couldn't take him off life support long enough to do them.
That makes complete sense. Have you had a chance to talk to the EMTs that first responded, just to, or do you even know who they are to where you could get in touch with them?
Yes, I got the run report and I have the names. I haven't spoke to any of them, but I go back to that neck injury because they put him in a C-collar in the apartment. And one of the autopsy photos, so the weird thing is, if you've seen the autopsy, he was if you see the photo of him, like, he had bruises all over his back, in his lung area, which can cause pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
He had bruises all down his sides, and there's this like bruising, and it's just black. I mean, it is just the darkest bruise right under where that collar was. And then you get the autopsy, and the back is almost
it's blank. Clean except the for the hand around the elbow and right above the left buttock. That's it.
Yeah. And then you look, and it's like you can still kind of see it. It almost looks like a shadow. But she said there was no bruising, and it really looks like his neck is like open. It looks like the, it's hard to describe. Like, you really have to look close. They didn't take good photos. They didn't take enough photos.
Yeah.
They just have like one photo of the backside of him. So when you're trying to look close, things are hard to see. But it really looks like his neck is split open.
Meanwhile, Ashboro Police Department has secured the scene at Brandon's apartment. The Criminal Investigation Division, or CID, arrived and started their investigation. The initial search warrant dated 9/13/19 includes swabs for evidence for DNA and blood samples, physical evidence to include hairs, fibers, and trace evidence, latent fingerprints, hypodermic needles, a pair of handcuffs, and documentation to show ownership of 711 South Church Street in Ashboro, Apartment A. It also stated that the warrant could cover any weapons associated with the crime.
So while we're here, we want to briefly mention why Brandon had hypodermic needles in his apartment. So during Brandon's time in the Navy, he was actually a submariner who was directly responsible for the nuclear reactor, which is what powered the submarine. And so the radiation there is really high, and it can often impact the levels of testosterone in your body. So Brandon went and had some tests done, and the results confirmed that he had a low level. So he actually started prescription therapy to inject HCG into his body.
We're going to go ahead and play just a little bit more around Brandon's condition at the time.
Yes. So it was my daughter and myself that went to Brandon's apartment, and it was locked. So we didn't even go in. We called 911, and only the first responders went in. And so then they took him to the hospital. We went to the hospital. We were in the waiting room. We had already waited for hours. We never even spoke to the emergency room doctor. The detectives came out and they talked to us and took notes, and they asked if he was on any medication. And I said, just the testosterone that I know of. And that was prescription. And I did check everything out, and mm-hmm. they said he was basically a perfect patient. He did his blood test. He kept his levels good. So he was doing everything that he was supposed to do. And instead of them like reporting this medical condition or just saying that he was taking testosterone, they say steroid abuse.
That's what
and
it was.
I didn't say he was abusing, because I did know. I mean, I knew the prescription. It came by prescription. It wasn't like some kind of like street steroid that he was buying. And you cannot abuse testosterone like that, because like I said, they're not going to prescribe it unless you're doing your blood test and things mm-hmm. like that, because they're responsible for, you know, the effects. And they also told me that the, you know, when you would hear about those teenagers having road rage,
yes,
kind of a long time ago, but you know, it was like really popular and you'd hear a lot about it. He told me a lot of that was people would take animal steroids.
Oh my goodness.
And they were not designed for humans, and they would buy them like off market. They weren't mm-hmm. going to a clinic or something like that. And that is why they would have these reactions.
So with a reported medical history, they have anabolic steroid abuse, that they also have psychosis, major depressive disorder. Did those describe Brandon at all, in your opinion?
Major depressive disorder, no. I know, like, there's something happened during his time in the military, like being on the submarine. I remember him saying, like, the food they would like, and I know this is true because I was in the Navy, and I've also heard, you know, a lot of the stories about the food on the ships and stuff. When they run out of food, you can't run to the grocery and go get some more. So they would just be making whatever. And, you know, he said that they would like make stuff out of ketchup, like ketchup for spaghetti sauce, or, you know, it was just like, just not great conditions. And he said it got to where, you know, because he worked directly on the nuclear reactor that kept the submarine going. So a lot of times when people would get the release, he wouldn't be able to get the release because he had to keep the submarine going. I don't know about the psychosis or anything like that. So he did have anxiety, and there may have been a depressive time. I know, like I said, when he was, you know, when he had that bad breakup, it was very hard on him, but he always bounced back. And at the time, you know, of his death, like things were okay. He was in a great mood when he came over Friday, and he had just lost his job that Friday, which was a really strange thing, but he was in a really good mood, and I don't think it had affected him because since he had got to North Carolina, he had taken different positions, and, you know, some he left to go to a better job, and then, you know, like this one, he was let go. But the thing was that through all the job transitions that he had, he kept getting better jobs. And at any time, like even like driving home, picking him up from the airport, he would have the headhunters calling him and things like that, because he had a lot of really special skill sets mm-hmm. that not everybody can do. And I did not see any, you know, depression or anything. I was trying to call him that Eeyore personality. He was more of the glass is half full, half empty, mm-hmm. but, you know, not a depressive state. And I think they thought, like, because his apartment was a wreck when they went in, that they were trying to say that he was depressed, but he was always messy to start with. And then on top of that, his apartment had been ransacked because I had been there with him helping him pack. And I know, like, everything that had been boxed up and that stuff, his apartment was trash. Somebody made a good point that they think someone may have even done that intentionally to make it look like someone broke in on him, trashed his apartment, and beat him and everything to make it look like a scene.
Detective Macon wrote in the search warrant that he was able to obtain a search warrant on the apartment. While he was conducting a search of the residence and gathering evidence, he was unable to locate the victim's wallet and keys inside of the apartment. He was also unable to locate the victim's keys to his silver 2016 Chevrolet Silverado, which was parked outside his apartment door with the truck doors unlocked, one parking space to the south. He then requested a search warrant of the vehicle because this search warrant would assist the APD in the investigation of Mr. Embry's apparent assault. And I want to be sure that we're clear on that they're thinking that somebody had attacked
Brandon. Oh, yeah. The second search warrant filed by Detective Suddeth, dated 9/13/2019, requested that any weapon, including but not limited to any knives or blunt objects that were used to make the contusion that was located on Mr. Embry's back and upper arm. This would also include any trace evidence located on or near the object that is consistent with being the above stated knives or blunt objects. Any and all evidence found to be related to the injuries of Brandon Embry.
On the continuation of the probable cause affidavit, within the second search warrant, it states in Section 3 that it appeared that Mr. Embry's wounds could have been self-inflicted, but upon examination, it was learned that Mr. Embry suffered from injuries that were most likely not self-inflicted. It was initially believed that Mr. Embry's wounds just consisted of a small laceration to the face and a cut to the right wrist. Mr. Embry was wrapped in a heating blanket and compression blanket due to his condition while at Randolph Hospital.
In Section 4, Detective Suddeth continues. After the initial search warrant on the apartment was executed, detectives learned that the extent of Mr. Embry's injuries are life-threatening and may not have been self-inflicted. Mr. Embry's injuries included what appeared to be defensive wounds to his right palm, several contusions to his head with one large contusion to the right side above his ear. Mr. Embry also has contusions on his back, which are consistent with being struck with a hard object, such as a metal rod or a baseball bat. And Mr. Embry's nose appears to be broken due to it leaning to his right side. Several medical professionals stated to this detective that these wounds could not be self-inflicted. And upon receiving an update from Moses Cohn on Mr. Embry's condition on 9/13/2019, this detective learned that Mr. Embry's body temperature has dropped to around 85 degrees, his pupils are fixed and dilated, and his organs are beginning to shut down.
In Section 6, Detective Suddeth states, the keys and wallet belonging to Brandon Embry were not located inside the apartment. The door to Mr. Embry's apartment can only be locked from the outside with a key or from the inside without a key. Mr. Embry was found in a position that he could not have locked the door, leading detectives to believe that the door was locked by another person after Mr. Embry was injured. In an effort to locate Mr. Embry's door key, which could contain fingerprints or DNA evidence to show who locked the door, this detective believes probable cause exists for a search of Mr. Embry's vehicle.
In Section 7, Detective Suddeth asked the court to find probable cause to issue the search warrant to the above stated facts and those responsible for Mr. Embry's injuries be identified and brought to justice.
So the following items were seized from Brandon's apartment. So it was a shower rod, a sledgehammer, a handcuff key with a fitness tag. I'm not really sure what that was. The handwriting was kind of hard to read, so it may have been some other kind of tag. A metal clipboard, a metal pipe, two pieces of paper, and a firearm suppressor. Seven items were collected in total.
So typically we wouldn't read all of the details of a search warrant in an episode, but as we continue, I want you to remember the following. Detective Suddeth didn't actually believe that Brandon's injuries were self-inflicted, and he received confirmation of this from several medical professionals who actually stated that the wounds could not be self-inflicted. This will be an important piece to remember as we continue in Brandon's story.
On Friday, September 13th at 8:57 p.m., Brandon succumbed to his injuries and passed away. His body was then transferred to the medical examiner for an autopsy. On Monday, September 16th at 11:10 a.m., Brandon's autopsy was performed. In attendance was Lauren C. Scott, M.D., Mr. Donald Allen, Detective Johnson, and Detective Macer from the Asheboro Police Department. The following is a summary and interpretation from the medical examiner, and this is a direct quote. The decedent was a 33-year-old male, last known alive on 9/10/19, at which time he was complaining of a headache. He was found unresponsive and naked in his bedroom, bathroom floor, on 9/12/19 after his mother could not gain access to his residence and called law enforcement. The front door was secured with a deadbolt lock. An internal door near the bathroom was torn off its hinges and portions of the toilet were removed. In addition, there was extensive clutter around the house with several disheveled and overturned items. Syringes and alcohol containers were found at the scene. He was transported to Randolph Hospital and then Moses Cohn Hospital. Urine drug screen on admission was negative with the exception of benzos, which are antidepressants. No fractures or other injuries were noted on imaging of the head, maxillofacial region, abdomen, or pelvis. On chest imaging, there was bilateral consolidation with a differential of contusion or pneumonia. After admission to the hospital, he was diagnosed with respiratory distress syndrome, sepsis, rhabdomyolysis, and tonic-clonic seizures. He was placed on comfort care measures on 9/13/2019. He had a medical history of anabolic steroid use and depression. He had a hospital admission on 2/18/19 for respiratory failure of undetermined etiology.
Findings at autopsy included extensive contusions with associated small abrasions of the lower extremities, contusions with associated abrasions of the left chest, a superficial contusion of the lower lobe of the left lung, healing lacerations of the head, incised wounds of the hands, right foot, and right wrist, a laceration and contusion of the upper frenula and lip, and intramuscular hemorrhage of the left tongue. The observed injuries are not severe enough to have resulted in death or hypoxic injury of the brain.
And I'm going to go ahead and apologize in advance. We think it's important that you get the autopsy report, but I am not a person who is schooled in anything medical. So if I slaughter these words, which I can guarantee you I will, please accept my apologies. Evidence of natural disease included moderate cardiomegaly with concentric left ventricular hypertrophy, which is heart enlargement with thickening of the wall of the left lower chamber of the heart, acute tubular necrosis, which is damage of structures in the kidneys, and moderate hepatic steatosis, which is the fatty change of the liver. There was severe and extensive pneumonia of the lungs with sparing of the left upper lobe. The most common cause of cardiomegaly with left ventricular hypertrophy is hypertension, which is high blood pressure.
Toxicologic analysis of antemortem blood drawn on September 12, 2019, detected no benzos, cocaine metabolite, ethanol, gabapentin, pregabalin, opiates or opioids, or other organic bases. Diphenhydramine, which is Benadryl, was detected at a level not expected to be toxic.
Based on autopsy and investigative findings as currently understood, it is my opinion that the cause of death is complications of pneumonia with hypertensive cardiovascular disease, possibly contributory to death. Severe pneumonia can cause sepsis with multi-organ failure as diagnosed upon admission. Based on results of chest imaging on admission, it does appear that the pneumonia predated the hospital admission. Heart enlargement can elicit a cardiac arrhythmia, which is an electrical abnormality in the heart, that can cause cerebral hypoxia, which is a lack of oxygen supply to the brain, and multi-organ failure. It is unclear what the precipitating event was that caused the decedent's superficial injuries. However, since the injuries were not contributory to death, the manner of death is classified as natural. So before we go on, I wonder who was surprised about the cause of death being natural based on what we talked about. I know that it was a shock for me.
Oh, yeah, for me too, especially after looking at the photos of the crime scene, which we will put up on the website for viewers to see, correct?
We definitely will.
Yeah, because I personally do not agree with this medical examiner.
Well, apparently, she didn't agree with her initial cause of death either, because there was an addendum, and I'll let you go ahead and read what she had to say on February 7th.
Yep. So there was an addendum on February the 7th of 2020 that said, "My opinion as to the cause and manner of death has changed to undetermined for both cause and manner. Upon further discussion of the case after the autopsy report has been finalized, it was postulated that the decedent's hypoxia and organ damage may have been precipitated by a substance ingestion on September the 10th, 2019, that had metabolized by September the 12th, 2019, and hence was no longer in the decedent's system at the time the blood sample, which underwent the toxicologic testing, was drawn. As a substance ingestion may have been the cause of death, and this cannot be proven or disproven based on autopsy findings, it is now my opinion that the cause of death is undetermined. If a substance ingestion precipitated the decedent's decline, manner of death would be accident rather than natural.
as it is still also a possibility that a natural process like a cardiac arrhythmia or pneumonia precipitated the decedent's death, as stated above. Manner of death is therefore amended to undetermined. Other opinions and findings as listed in the above original autopsy summary remain unchanged. So the autopsy results went from a natural cause to undetermined. But one thing I find that's really interesting is all of the physical injuries aren't attributed to anything. So I'm wondering, and obviously we don't know what the state of mind was at the time, but I'm wondering what led the medical examiner to come up
with this. Why did she change her mind?
Yeah, like, why did she change her mind? And then why wasn't there more focus
on the injuries that he sustained?
Now, I will say in the autopsy report, which we'll put online, there is very little drawing on the back of Brandon's body.
I noticed that when I looked at it.
Yeah, and so we have pictures of Brandon's back and the rest of his body, and there are quite a few bruises and lacerations that aren't captured.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they were just missed. They're very obvious. I mean,
to me, at least. I mean, in the photos, I'm not a medical examiner, but
not by any means me either.
I feel like based upon the pictures that we've seen of Brandon's back, those are blatantly obvious areas that needed more attention than they got.
And the other thing that just really strikes me is in the search warrant, the detective, Detective Sudduth, had talked about Brandon's face and how he had bruises around his eyes and he had a broken nose, or appeared to be a broken nose. And again, I mean, to me, as just a regular citizen, it looks like that there was some type of altercation.
Oh, definitely. And his face, like you said, the amount of bruising, it to me, his whole entire face was swollen too.
It was.
And like Sarah, his mother, said, you couldn't see the contusions or lacerations around his neck because he had the C collar on. So I just feel like, and again, I'm not a medical examiner, but I just feel like they didn't pay enough attention to the actual shape of his body. It was more internally versus externally, which is mind-blowing in a situation like this where there's so much going on, there's so much surrounding his death. I just feel like you should pay attention to as much externally as you are internally, and I just don't think that that was done.
Yeah, and I mean, again, we're not experts and we could be wrong. It's just two people's opinions, but we just feel that maybe another look should just be taken, just comparing the photography to the actual autopsy. So Sarah told us that months later, she learned that Detective Johnson had a unique theory on what happened to Brandon. Detective Johnson speculated that Brandon OD'd on meth. He then went crazy and beat himself to death. So I have never heard of anyone on meth
beating themselves to death.
So I thought, well, I mean, surely that has to be something that has happened before, and I'm just completely clueless. So I spent probably an hour just researching, trying to find another instance, just one of someone beating themselves to death, whether or not they were high on meth. I mean, I couldn't find anyone.
I was going to say, did you find
I couldn't find anyone who was high on meth. I did find one case that this person struck themselves with a heavy object just once on the head, and that caused them to die. But the
repetitively beating themselves.
No, and it was a one and done. There were no drugs involved. He just hit himself with a heavy object and died. But that was the only time I could find where someone had struck themselves and had died as a result. So it's just interesting to me that
it's not common.
Yeah. So I couldn't find anything else to prove out the theory. And then also, once Brandon's toxicology screening came back, it proved once and for all that Brandon did not have meth in his system. And I wanted to look to see how long meth stays in the system. And there's varying responses, but I think I found what I thought was one of the best responses from Banyan Treatment Center in Chicago. And they say every person is different, so there is no time set for how long meth stays in your system. Several factors are at play and can affect the number. Generally, the high for meth starts relatively quickly, and withdrawal begins as soon as a day after use stops. Meth remains in the body system for much longer. The metabolism of meth is faster in some places than others, but traces of meth in your system can be found even months later. So, you know, there is that comment in the autopsy about maybe he ingested something and then it metabolized. Yeah. But if it wasn't that meth, it should have shown up.
Honestly, though, even if it were synthetic marijuana, which is eventually what it comes out to be, synthetic marijuana doesn't even stay in your system that long.
Mm-mm. So I'm going to play a little excerpt from Sarah, just what she's talking about, the call that she had with the medical examiner.
The medical examiner. And I mean, I'm a mom, you know, that that mama bear was coming out, and I was just like, I was really pressing her. And I said, you know, have you seen a lot of cases where people get pneumonia and beat themselves to death? And she said, yes. And I've looked, I've researched, I can't find any. I can't, you know, and even when I Googled, you know, for the drugs, I didn't find someone who could actually beat themselves to death.
Mm-mm.
And so, you know, by the end of the conversation, she says, well, I can't actually explain his injuries. Mm-hmm. So it was just something, I feel like they just wanted to write something down and be finished with it. It didn't matter if it was factual or not. And another thing was on the pneumonia, he hadn't been sick. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't running a fever or anything. And then, when I was talking to the medical examiner, and she said, well, and I said, if Brandon was sick, he would have reached out to someone. He would have wanted to go to the doctor. If he was so sick that he had pneumonia so bad that it would come to that point. And she said, well, he didn't contact anyone in February, now did he? So I go back and I'm looking through the medical records, and it never said that he had pneumonia. He didn't. They tested him for both types of flu. He didn't have that. And then I see it, and it says his lungs were clear. Uh-huh. But yet he was in respiratory distress. And that's why that is, you know, more a sign of poisoning.
Yes.
It never said that he had pneumonia. It was just, you know, something they couldn't explain. There is no pneumonia in that record.
According to the toxicology report, the only substances present in Brandon's system were Benadryl and nicotine.
So Brandon's apartment was released by the Asheboro Police Department on September 18th of 2019. In order to save Brandon's mom, Sarah, from the trauma of cleaning up, her husband, Ridge, and his brother went to start the process of cleaning up and cleaning out. So Sarah was at home, but she just kept having a feeling that she needed to be there. So on September the 19th, she arrived at Brandon's apartment. We will use an excerpt from Sarah's blog to describe what she witnessed.
I arrive and take a deep breath to prepare myself to go in. The men are busy bagging and tossing, going through things. I go in and first see the largest pool of blood on the floor. It was dried, but I observed it. It didn't look like a wet liquid blood. It was more like globular circles of blood that made up one big circle. Thick. The blood that used to run through my living, breathing son, who is now laying in a morgue. Next, I see the blood on the wall and the letter markings of the crime scene investigators. I notice how the blood travels in a downward pattern on the wall. I notice other blood that's not marked, blood on the adjacent wall, blood covered closet door, blood on the window ledge and underneath the window ledge, blood is on the mini blind, blood is on the mattress, blood all around the perimeter of the mattress and down the side of the mattress, blood on the third wall, blood-soaked pillows. It's horrific. Poor Brandon, how did you suffer? My heart, my soul hurts for him. Some of the blood on the wall had hair in it and matter. What is this mass in the blood? Then I go into the bathroom. I realize someone did this to him. I walk up closely to the wall behind the toilet and see large areas of blood that look mixed with water. Then I see more blood on the wall beside it, again looking like the blood had liquid running through it. As I'm bent over looking at this blood on the wall, I see the same blood on the toilet tank above the seat. It gives me the shivers. There is blood in so many places. Blood on the bathroom door. I walk over to the mirror and notice a round shape of blood again with the liquid running through it. Was this a head print in the mirror? There is hair in the broken mirror. What is this liquid in the blood? It looks like when you spray a cleanser and it runs down and leaves lines. Did someone attempt to clean up? I start taking photos. I feel like seeing all this blood and it not being marked, something is amiss. I start talking to my husband and brother-in-law about the blood. They stop cleaning and start looking at the blood with me. My husband starts finding what he feels is high-speed blood spatter based on the distance and pattern, blood almost up to the ceiling. I ask, where are the sheets and the comforter? Did they take them for evidence? My husband said no. They were completely soaked with water and he took them to the dumpster. I sigh. I need them. I need to see them. I ask him to please go get them. I take them out in the backyard area and spread them out. You can see large orange tinted areas all over the sheets and comforter where the blood is mixed with water. I take more photos. You can see the orange tinge of blood where it mixed with all the water that flooded from the bathroom. I never understood why these weren't bagged up for evidence. Maybe I'm too thorough or too overly detailed. To me, there may have been DNA or clues in the bedding. My husband said the linens were so full of water when he and his brother initially bagged them up, it took both men to lift the bag. Brandon's typical water bill was $32. Brandon was gone about 3 weeks to Detroit and a couple of days at my home dog sitting, so his current water bill should have been around $8 to $12. Brandon's water bill for only being home a couple of days was $133. So a water bill that should have been no more than $12 because he was away for most of the month was $133. Later, we find even more blood inside the large water heater closet and in very odd places. And there is something so off about it because it is past where my son laid. What happened in the closet? What is the sequence of what happened by looking at the blood? The more I see, the more questions I have. After surveying the many blood stains in the bedroom, I start walking into the dimly lit yellow cast bathroom. I observe broken things, missing things. The toilet paper holder is not there. The towel bar is broken away from the wall with only an attachment left to show where it once was. The porcelain toilet tank lid broke in half, my mind immediately jumping to how heavy it is and why it would be broken. Taking everything in, I see the toilet lid and seat torn from the toilet, the shards of broken mirror. My eye catches the busted drywall behind the toilet. I walk closer and start to see the faint color of blood, smeared in places, very possibly white with liquid running through it. I follow it, then notice blood on the smaller adjacent wall, then the blood in the mirror and underneath on the wall. Later, going through photos, I look closer. The blood looks wiped. There are small hairs, possibly body hairs stuck in the wall, maybe Brandon's. Possibly the hairs were transferred from a cloth to the wall. Hair would not be stuck to the wall. There had to be an additional substance to make the hair stick to the wall. Why is there blood all over the toilet? I think it's from a struggle. I think Brandon's body took some impact force that broke the drywall and left blood on the wall.
Yeah, when I went through the medical records, they didn't really know what was wrong with him. And how I put it together was in the crime scene photos, there's this blood-soaked pillow. It's completely soaked mm-hmm. with blood. And also absorbed a lot of water, and the water didn't even wash the blood out. I mean, you can still see all of the blood on there, but there's this green liquid that goes all around the pillow too, which was really puzzling because going through all of the crime scene photos, there's nothing in the photos that I could see that would turn the pillow green, and he never made it out of that room. So, you know, I was like, you know, it's like how they tried to say he took a drug and self-inflicted. I'm like, okay, well, he didn't make it out of this space. So where would that be? And that's the same with, you know, the cuts and the blood that he had all over him. And I go through the room, there's nothing in there. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing laying there, some kind of tool or something that has blood all over it. I mean, there's just so much that looks like there was cleanup. you know, I just feel like their approach was, how do we blame this on him instead of how do we find who did this to him? And one of the things that I read, and I've also heard on these shows that I've been watching, but this, you know, they said homicide detectives look at every death as a homicide until it's proven otherwise. But with Brandon, it was like I had to keep going to them and going to them and being like, look, things are not right. This is, he couldn't, how do you beat yourself on your back? How do you beat yourself on your neck? You know, and his neck bones look displaced.
Okay. So Lindsay, do you have, I think you mentioned that you had some additional questions. Do we cover those in our conversation, or do you have anything outside of what we talked about?
I think we covered them for the most part, just in general conversation, but I did have two other questions. The first one was in relation to all of the blood splatter that you and your husband found in Brandon's apartment. Did they ever have anyone come out and do an analyzation of the blood splatter, or did they just kind of say, well, that's not really relevant, so they just kind of pushed it to the side?
They just pushed it to the side. There was blood on at least 8 walls. My husband found blood spatter at the top of the ceiling.
And inside the closet, down, correct?
Yeah.
Inside the closet was a lot. Where the closet doors were, there was a lot. And there was a, I found a spot that was on the water heater. So it did have movement to it. And they didn't have anyone like come in and look at anything. They measured one wall of like 8, and they said it was they said the blood was him coughing.
Clapping?
Oh my god. Coughing.
Coughing. They said coughing. It was from him coughing. Like that he had pneumonia and he was coughing blood, and
oh my gosh,
that's what it was. Okay. That's what they told me. Now, that was told to my daughter-in-law, and she's in the medical profession.
Oh my gosh.
But there was, you know, and then also I do want to mention this so I don't forget, but they did say, so I finally sent a message to an email to the mayor and the city manager. And
I just saw that.
Yeah, they said that they're going to have an internal investigation, but the problem with that is it's the chief of the department who is doing the internal affairs, and he doesn't want, you know, that's his department that he's running. He doesn't want that to look bad, so I don't have a lot of faith of that being an internal affairs investigation. But I, you know, I said that if they come back and they're saying, oh, everything looks good here, then it's just more proof of a cover-up of how they're just trying to sweep this under the rug.
After witnessing the horrific scene at Brandon's apartment, she contacted the Ashbury Police Department to make sure that they didn't want to collect additional evidence.
We're going to listen to a couple more excerpts.
And even when I said, like, look at this blood, you know, it's got this spray running through it. There was no like bottle of spray, and they tried to say, well, that, so the detective said, well, that's what they do when they do drugs. They'll try to clean their own blood off the wall. And I thought, well, he never made it out of the bedroom, but there's no spray. There's no cleaning products. There's nothing, you know, to indicate he was trying to clean up his own blood. It looks more like somebody else did it and took the stuff with him.
Yeah.
And then later when it's, you know, and I go back to that. So I go to another meeting with the detective, and I tell her, like, you know, I still feel like somebody cleaned up and then there's spray all in that blood. Then she tells me, she said, oh, the CSI did that, by the way.
They don't
and
do that.
Then I was like, what? And I was like, you don't spray, you don't take obvious blood and spray so much Luminol or Blue Star on it that it's running down the wall because you mess up. Like, yep. First of all, you don't spray it on obvious blood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she just totally sat there and lied to me. Through the apartment, there was like so much in there. I couldn't believe that they had already released it, that they were already finished with it. I was like, wow, they've already turned it over. And then I go and I'm like, you know, I'm looking around, like, first I look in the bathroom, that's when I knew, like, just with all that destruction, something very, like, horrible happened here. And I said, well, where is the, like, where's the shower curtain? Where's the comforter? Because it was just a mattress. Where's the bedding for the clothes, the bed clothing? And my husband said, oh, it's out in the dumpster. We already threw it away.
Jeez.
And I was like, what? I expected that the police had taken it for forensics.
They should have.
So I made them go dig it out of the dumpster so I could take photos because there was blood. And that was one of the things that the medical examiner said, it didn't look like homicide because she didn't see enough blood. And I thought, well, how do you can't, you know, quantify
how much
blood.
Because,
you know, that can happen in so many different ways. But then I was like, well, what photos did they actually show her, you know, of what they took? And I had got that stuff out and I took my own photos of like the bedding and stuff like that. Because I kind of feel like it looks to me like possibly he was on the bed with the bedding and bled through the bedding to the mattress, and that's where that blood came from, but then the bedding ends up off the bed.
This is all the time we have for today, so we'll continue in part two next time. During this time, we will go over the communication that we had with Asheboro Police Department, the Randolph County DA, as well as dig a little bit more into female one in the communication that she had with Sarah, Brandon's mom. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks with part two.
Crime Mama Podcast is a production of Coastal Mama Productions. Theme music created by the talented Sam Morrison with Arkham Files Podcast. TCM Podcast is property of the True Crime Mamas LLC. Support your True Crime Mamas by following us on Instagram and Facebook. Check out our website, truecrimemamaspodcast.com, for some killer merch.